Welcome to the Fearless Women Podcast. We're inspiring conversations for the unafraid. I'm Janice McDonald, founder of the Beacon Agency, author, and global champion for women. Why am I making this show? Because I want to share the inspiring stories of women leaders in business, arts and culture, politics, and more with all of you. Hear how they've chosen to go forward and be bold and make the world a better place, even when it wasn't easy to do. Subscribe now wherever you find podcasts. Best-selling author, keynote speaker, regular business host for Fast Company, CNN, CTV, and so many more media outlets, Amber was recently named one of DMZ's 30 inspirational women making a difference in tech. Welcome to the Fearless Women Podcast, Amber Mack.
Thanks so much for having me.
And welcome to our listeners from all over the world, including Hong Kong, UK, Ireland, Australia, and more. So, Amber, you have moderated sessions with our own Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, and famed astronaut Chris Hadfield, among others. How do you prepare for interviews with big names like these? Is it a different strategy?
I think it really is a different strategy. I think when you know that the stakes are a little bit higher and you're interviewing people, especially politicians, you need to make sure that you do your homework. There is also the added factor that oftentimes you need to, of course, work with their teams and make sure that they've had a chance to do everything from vet you to review questions. So for me personally, I think because I do have a background in journalism, it has been really good training as far as understanding how to prepare for an interview. And I think the most important thing for going into a high profile interview like that is that you have done your homework, you know what you're going to ask, but that you also listen and you're open to taking the interview in a different direction, because it's really those spontaneous moments that makes those interviews so special.
Yeah, agree. When I launched the first Canadian online music website selling CDs in the 1990s, remember that when we called it the World Wide Web? I used to do all of the interviews with bands and artists for content on our site. And boy, you had to be exactly like you said, allow for spontaneity, because it was sometimes happening on the tour bus, sometimes on a picnic table outside, and often not on time. Is that the same with some of the big names? Is scheduling sometimes a challenge?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, with the example that I shared with you as far as the Prime Minister also recognizing that for security purposes, they don't often release his schedule until a couple of days before he may appear at an event. So that's another added factor. It's not as though I had 3 months to prepare for our interview. In fact, if I was realistic, I would say I probably had 3 or 4 days. And that was 3 or 4 days from the time I even knew that they were considering me.
Right. Yeah. So you got to get ready and go.
Absolutely.
So Eleanor Roosevelt said, do one thing every day that scares you. Does that resonate with you? And if so, what's a recent example?
Yes, it definitely resonates with me. I would say that I'm definitely not a fearless person. I would say that I'm a person who has been really kind of bounded by fear in terms of everything from having a fear of flying to a fear of public speaking. And if you follow me on social media, that's pretty much what I do every single week. So,
yes.
You know, every week I'm confronted with the reality that I'm doing a job that at one point I would have thought was impossible for me. And I think I've learned to accept over the years, and I've been doing this for a long time, and finally I understand that that fear is just part of the motivation for me, as far as understanding, you know what, if I don't feel afraid, then there really is no risk involved. And it's through that risk that I think that we're able to become successful in certain industries. And so I don't let the fear really get to me as much as it used to, but I would argue that it's been definitely a lot of work in terms of overcoming fear. Those two are just two examples.
So you essentially, as time has passed, you now fear less, but you're not fearless, if I'm hearing you correctly.
Exactly. I mean, I've probably done 300 or 400 events. I did 4 or 5 even just last week. I did one in Orlando. And I would argue even today that every single event I go to, especially with larger audiences, that I'm backstage and there's a part of me that just really wants to run away. and you know, find the exit door and think, oh my gosh, who is this person who's doing this? But the amazing thing to me is that after you've done something enough, it's sort of the Malcolm Gladwell example of putting 10,000 hours in, is that there really is that muscle memory. So often, you know, I may be really full of fear backstage, but then when I go on stage, because I've done it so many times, it's amazing to me just that, you know, it kicks in and I know what I'm doing. So, you know, I would argue that I was not a person who naturally fell into things such as professional speaking, but through practice and, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of hours of work, I've been able to finally feel comfortable.
Yeah. And I have heard other experts say when they're feeling that feeling in their body, they remind themselves, oh, this means this is important to me. So for you, is there a quote or a mantra that you like to use to when you're, you know, when your body's going like, whoa, let's run? Is there something you refer to that kind of gets you back on track?
That's a really good question. And I think really what ends up happening is because I've done so many events is that I end up really quickly kind of thinking about those past events and reinforcing that I've done this before, right? This isn't the first time that I've gotten on stage. This isn't the first time that I've been in front of a large audience. So, you know, through the success of doing hundreds and hundreds of keynote speeches, I think what has happened is that I think to myself, you know what, if I screw this one up or if something happens or maybe I have a full-blown panic attack in the middle of it and I left the stage, it still wouldn't sink my career. I mean, I've proven over years that I've done enough of these, right? So it's weird how just that recognition and putting things into perspective for me personally has really helped me as far as becoming less fearful and actually even more confident on stage. So it's had a real benefit. But again, that didn't happen overnight. That has been something that has evolved. I've been doing this for 12 years, particularly when we talk about the speaking on stage. So you really have to put the time in and you have to, I think, do it regularly. If I'm not speaking at events or I have a break, if someone asks me to speak at a conference or I have the opportunity to get on stage, I take it, not because I want to, but I know I get rusty unless I'm out there doing it.
I think very practical advice for everybody listening to reflect back on past success when maybe you're having that moment of lack of confidence. So very helpful. What about the 10-year-old Amber? What was she like? What were you into? You've shared that you attended a 2-room schoolhouse. So what'd you learn from that experience? Take us back.
I think it was a really special upbringing. And I know it's a situation that many people across the country can relate to if you aren't from an urban area. I grew up in rural Prince Edward Island and went to a really small school, kind of grade 1 in one row, grade 2 in another row. And I lived in the country and there were, you know, lots of cows around and potato fields. And it was exactly how you would imagine growing up on PEI. And I'm going to be honest with you, I think what that ended up doing for me, aside from having a really strong sense of community and family, is that it allowed me to become curious because there wasn't a heck of a lot going on and we didn't have cable TV and access to technology like we do today. So I was always really curious and I had a big imagination. So that meant if I went outside into the back field or explored the forest near us, I mean, I was always interested in learning more because I sort of had to make more of my circumstances. And it's that curiosity for me that has really led to having an appetite for knowledge and talking and interviewing people even today.
So tell us about your best-selling book, Power Friending. Why did you write it? And how does that relate to those early days, you know, of curiosity and making friends with whoever is around?
I would really kind of placing a bet that social media was going to be big and in fact have perhaps a larger influence even than mainstream media way back, you know, in 2008, 2009. And so when I put that book out in 2010, I was really thinking that this was finally the opportunity for individuals like myself, as well as businesses and brands to be able to leverage the social media space to grow a business without actually putting a lot of money forward. So it was really an exciting time. And at that time, a lot of people were unsure of how to use social media. So a lot of what I was doing was essentially going out and doing seminars and workshops and teaching people how to use these tools and tech. And, you know, many people today, of course, have a great understanding of how to leverage social media. But in those early days, there was a lot of confusion and people needed case studies and proof that this was the direction that they should be heading.
Yeah, and you love tech. So what are some of your favorite apps? What do we need to know? Like, hey, use this. This is going to be a perfect hack for your life right now.
Well, I think the exciting thing is that there are so many tools and technologies. And, you know, if you don't have a large budget and you're trying to go out and establish yourself as a thought leader, I think this is a really exciting time. You know, I'll give you a couple of examples, and these are relatively new tools and technologies. One that I've been exploring lately is called Lumen 5. And it's a service that allows you to turn a blog post into a video automatically. So basically, it uses new tech like artificial intelligence to essentially scan the blog post that maybe you put on your blog, and then it chooses from different images that it has in its database, and it puts together a video that you can share based on something you've already written. This is just one example of, I think, how new technologies like artificial intelligence can streamline this process of creating content. So, you know, what does that do for the average person who's an entrepreneur or building a brand? It means that instead of having to hire someone and go out and shoot a video and appear on camera, that one piece of content that you've created for your blog can then be turned into something powerful, such as video content.
Very practical. Thank you for that. So you also co-wrote a best-selling book on Amazon called Outsmarting Your Kids Online. So what are some tips to do that? Because it can be kind of scary, everything that's available, and actually our addiction to our phones. I know there's a lot of talk now about taking a digital detox. But, you know, as a mother, how are you managing that the challenge of tech in your child's life? And what's your advice to people listening?
I really have struggled with this in terms of one of the reasons that I ended up wanting to work on that book was because I think there were so many questions coming my way from parents. And I get asked this question all the time of what does it take? What should you do? And just the other day, I did an interview and I think I finally figured out what I think is probably this little tiny kernel of truth that can be helpful for parents. Mm-hmm. The most important thing is that you have these conversations with your kids, not once a year, once, you know, every 6 months. I really believe that once a week, you need to do a digital check-in. And that check-in is, you know, hey, what new apps are you trying? And, oh, that's really cool. Can you show me how that works? Or, you know, I want to follow you on social media. What are you into these days? Or what videos are you watching? And just show this interest and curiosity. It's not to come from a perspective of attacking in terms of what they're doing, but an understanding of what they're doing. And then you can gather knowledge outside of that as far as guiding them on the right path. So I think the biggest mistake that parents make is they think that this is something that they just need to check in on every few months. But let's be honest. I mean, there are apps out there like TikTok that all mm-hmm. of a sudden has become a place where, you know, many white nationalists are going and potentially infiltrating the streams of younger children. So we know that week to week that the tech is moving so quickly and the kids are on top of it and the parents just aren't.
Mm-hmm. My strategy has always been, why don't you show grandma what you have online? And boy, that's a sobering check for the kids right away. When they think I got to show grandma.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, but that's really powerful. And it's funny, as I was walking over to the studio today, I saw a mother driving in her car and her child was beside her and he had in his Apple iPods and they were at a red light and he was just, you know, going through tech on Instagram and I thought, oh boy, is that where we're at? We're like, we're together, but we're so alone. You know, so I love that idea of these check-ins and really like, do we need headphones in when we're driving in the car together, you know, beside each other? I don't think we do. But
no.
Yeah. So Outsmarting Your Kids Online, the book is available on Amazon. And for any of you that want smart tips, please go check it out there. Take us back. So you started your own digital agency in 2006. Your first client was the famous business coach, Tony Robbins. So how did you land him as a client? And second, what was he like to work with? Any lasting lessons from, because that's a big name for a small company when you were starting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I wish I could take more credit for that and say that, oh, we pursued him and I did this big pitch and we got a chance to work with them. But I think in many cases, it just sort of fell into my lap from the perspective that I was a bit early on as far as reporting on what was taking place in the social media space. There was an opportunity. He was coming through Toronto. The person who was managing a new tech project for him had recognized me for my work on Tech TV, got in touch and said, hey, would you be willing to meet with Tony Robbins? The wonderful wonderful and amazing part of that story was that Tony, of course, has an incredibly busy schedule. And the only time he was able to meet was while he was flying from Toronto to London, Ontario. So they asked me to go on his plane with him. And
somebody had to do it, right?
Right. That's when we were going to do the meeting. And this is sort of, you know, peak sort of fear of flying mode for me as far as, you know, I had stopped flying for a long time.
Oh my gosh,
and I'll never forget. I know, it was just the funniest story. I got it. I thought, this is what I mean. I'm often, I feel almost drawn towards fear sometimes, is that I know I can't miss opportunities. So there is a part of me that, you know, even though I'm really fearful of something, I will sort of, you know, go and do it. And I went on his plane and I was so nervous and I was, you know, trying to act cool. and then we were chatting and then we landed and I turned to him and I said, you know, I'm really sorry. I said, I'm actually a nervous flyer. And he turned to me and he was like, no kidding. I always laugh about that story because I was trying to play it cool in front of a person who has read millions of people in rooms. And he was like, that's why I was talking so much. You were literally like sweating and frozen in fear. And that's how we started working together. So it was a pretty funny moment. And I learned so many things from him, to be honest with you, from attending his conferences and working with him. Most importantly, I think the number one tip would be that so often when we're younger, we have a blueprint of what our life is supposed to look like. And we hold on to that. And if it doesn't happen, we just get into this perpetual state of disappointment. And I think after working with him, I recognized that, yes, you know, the path that I thought I was going to take was definitely not the path that I was on. And that was okay. So I kind of threw that blueprint out the window. And once you let go of that, I feel like life is a whole lot easier.
That's wonderful. And your business is growing so fast and really well. Any advice on how to grow your business to over $1 million for people listening?
Yeah. So after about 5 years in business, we had our first year where we exceeded $1 million in annual revenue. And I think there's a couple things that we did right. The first is we had multiple streams of income. So we weren't reliant upon just doing one thing. You know, I have my speaking career. We did video production. We did social media consulting. And that really helped us as far as the ebb and flow of different business that was coming in. I think the second thing is that we live in a really incredible time today as far as building a business through subcontractors or freelancers. And that's a lot of what we do. You know, we don't only have 2 full-time employees and then about 6 or 8 people who regularly subcontract with us. And that works out well for them and works out well for us. There is this pressure that people want to build businesses and have fancy offices and lots of employees. And I would say I've seen people go down that path and the majority of them end up in a state where they just can't afford to operate like that. So, you know, be realistic and modest about what you actually need. And I think the third thing is not to underestimate the power of building your brand on social. I put out so much content. You know, it's not paid content. A lot of the content that I put out is content that I'm just making in my free time. I'm writing video ideas on planes and then shooting video when I, you know, have a chance. And I think, you know, if people don't know who you are, how are they going to find you? How are they going to do business with you? So you have to show them who you are. And I think we underestimate how powerful that piece can be.
Really practical advice. That's amazing. Sarah Blakely of Spanx fame said, "Don't be intimidated by what you don't know. That can be your greatest strength and ensure you do things differently from everyone else." And you started your career in San Francisco and Boston during the dot-com boom. What took you to the U.S. at the start of your career?
I had actually just graduated from a master's in journalism program, and I was working at CBC Charlottetown. And to be honest with you, you know, just to sort of echo what Sarah had said, I just felt as though I was way in over my head. You know, I was doing daily news for a couple of months, and I just didn't really have a handle on what life was about. And it was weird for me to be on camera telling people what was happening every day when I felt like I didn't have anything figured out in my own life. And so I ended up leaving and moving to San Francisco because of the dot-com boom and the opportunity there. And I had an interest in technology. And once I landed there, got really immersed in that scene. And it was just more of a learning experience for me of really focusing in and having kind of a niche, which I think allowed me to get back into journalism kind of indirectly and establish myself as an expert in the topic of technology. So I think, you know, it was a roundabout way just to figure out what exactly I was interested in.
That's great advice for anybody to just kind of go for it, right? Just yeah. Do it. So you have obviously an incredibly demanding career and you also have a young child. How do you manage those competing interests and what have advice do you have for women trying to strive to be successful in their career and to be a mother? I remember one of my friends would say, you know, I can't bake the cookies for the bake sale, but I can swing by and buy the Timbits that apparently always seem to go. So what's your approach?
You know, I think it's funny because I get asked this question sometimes, and I think sometimes I'll talk about, you know, balance and health and fitness and all those things. But I think it's probably about time that I started to give my husband a little bit of credit. And I would say, if you have an opportunity, pick the right partner. I cannot stress enough that, you know, when I'm traveling, I have no concerns that, you know, my son is in good hands with my husband. I know they're going to have fun. He's organized. He can keep up to date with what's going on. He you know, helps. And as far as managing the house, and we work together on our business as well. So to me, that's such a big part of it. I see so many women who are struggling and trying to do everything. And I think, you know, it's a matter of, you know, saying to your partner, if you have one, and if it's important to you, listen, I need help. I can't do all of this. And, you know, I drive my husband a little bit crazy because I leave notes around the house and, and tell him what I need him to do. And that helps to avoid, you know, the arguments about, you know, who's taking out the garbage or who's doing this. And that allows for more of an equal distribution of work. But I just see in too many households where women are doing, you know, not only just all the work at home, but also outside of the home. And that's just not fair. And I think the only way to get around that is not necessarily to complain, but instead say, hey, you know what? I need help. And here are the things I need you to help me with. And at that point, I think you'll have the support that you need.
Yes. Amazing advice. Ask for help, ladies. Final question, yes. Amber. What's your dream for Canada?
Oh, wow. That's a big one. So I am really, really, really concerned right now in terms of the future of this country. And, you know, not just from a political standpoint, but I just worry as far as where we're headed. I worry about education for the next generation, how artificial intelligence is going to impact the future of work. And I think that we really are at an important time in history right now where we have the opportunity as a country to be a leader in terms of, you know, being so progressive on so many fronts, whether it's for the LGBTQ community or on the artificial intelligence front. We are really well positioned to be able to move forward in an incredible way. But at the same time, I believe that there are threats in this country that could potentially set us off on a path that we don't want to go down. So most importantly, right now, my hope and dream for this country is that people really wake up to the situation that we're in right now, become educated, become curious, become action oriented, and get involved with what's happening instead of having your heads in the sand or, you know, scrolling through Instagram all night.
Amber, it is no surprise that DMZ called you one of their 30 inspirational women making a difference in tech. You're passionate about our country and you're deeply knowledgeable about the tech space. Best-selling author, keynote speaker, of course, a regular business host for Fast Company, CNN, CTV, and so many others. It has been an absolute pleasure speaking to you today, Amber Mack. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Fearless Women podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening. We want our community to grow. Tell your friends, follow us on Instagram, and sign up for our newsletter at fearlesswomenpodcast.com to get the early scoop. Subscribe in Apple Podcasts or in your favorite app. And if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star rating. I'm Janice McDonald. Stay fearless. Thank you to the 30% Club organization for your support of the Fearless Women podcast. The 30% Club believes that gender balance on boards and in senior management encourages better leadership, governance, and all-around better board performance. Want to learn more? Visit their website at 30percentclub.org to find out about membership, supporters, and their key initiatives. Thank you to BDC, the bank devoted exclusively to entrepreneurs, for your support of the Fearless Women podcast. We love smart companies that want to amplify women's voices. For more information, go to bdc.ca/women.